pals o' mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. I love wine news stories, such as the one about the Israeli researchers claiming that it helps with type 2 diabetes, or the Harvard study claiming weight loss, in which the subjects drank half a bottle of wine a day. Well, that's good enough for me. And lucky for me, I live in Northern California, surrounded by some of the best wines in the world. Now, periodically, I'll take a long drive and spend some time in a small town. Recently, it was the town of Winters, where you'll find the lovely Main Street Cellars. I spoke with its owner, sommelier Michael Peterson, about the joys of California wine.
Now, if I was a sommelier, I would think that I would enjoy being in a small town like this as well. It just seems like you would get lost in a city just because you might have, not competition so much, but all these other wine cellars, vineyard wineries, kind of promoting their wares. But if someone can have a relaxing neighborhood where they're strolling, they can relax and really enjoy and appreciate the wines that they're tasting and being introduced to, as opposed to rushing around, it's happy hour, and going here and there, and it's just a place to get together on a Friday night.
Sure, I agree with that. The one thing I do notice is that we are very limited into the wines that we are exposed to. So I think a big city, you have more exposure with the sales reps or the distributors that would bring in other wines that we're not otherwise, they share with us, only due to our remoteness. But I think with the contacts and the relationships I've developed over the years, people know what to bring. And my background in the wine industry and the production side of it really allows people that would not normally come to this area will come as a salesperson, which gives me more exposure to wines that other places don't. And that's really our what we have here, and that's our point of difference, is that we do have such a wide variety of wines. And then we can share them with the guest. We can pour the wine for them and let them taste it, rather than trying to cipher through the melee that's, you know, the wine shelf that I think so many people suffer. And not knowing, you know, the lack of knowledge, or it's confusing. What we do is kind of help decipher that confusion and help make it easy by putting it in the, you know, let the person taste it and let them decide what they like. They might not be able to pronounce it. I might not be able to pronounce it, but you know right away when you put it in your mouth whether you like it or not. And that's what I'm most happy about here, is sharing things with people that they might not otherwise taste.
And also, as a person with experience, expertise, when someone, such as myself, indicates the type of wines that I prefer, you have a good idea of what to introduce.
I think so, and I think it goes back to the training, and when you're training and studying to be a sommelier, there's certain things you look for in a wine, certain triggers or characteristics that are in certain wines that you pinpoint immediately with your palate. And I think people are the same way. I think you get a feel, if you truly listen to them, there's really not many choices. You whittle it down quickly, or at least I can whittle it down quickly. I don't know how I've come to do that. I think we all have certain talents, and I'm fortunate enough to do what I love, and then that talent blossoms. And just, I think, listening to people, I think that's really the key. And then finding that wine. Again, there's only a few. You have red, white, and it's sweet, dry, full, medium, light body. So you really can narrow it down. And again, it's just getting a sense for the person. So it's a strange, innate ability.
A wine intuitive. Does anybody have that on their cards?
I don't think so. Director of the Nectar, Wine MD. Actually, I was the Wine MD for a long time, so maybe that is.
Okay, Doc.
Perfect.
Now, has anybody given you specifics on one they like? Because I'm not even remotely a connoisseur. I just know what I like. Mm-hmm. But I was at this wine tasting event, and there's something about this one particular glass tasting, and there was something that was different, and I couldn't put my finger on it. I asked the gal. She gave the usual spiel, and I kept shaking my head, saying, no, it's something, there's something, I can't put my finger on it. And then her other half, her partner, said, well, there's also pear. That's it. There's pear. And normally, I would never distinguish that. My palate isn't that sensitive. But for whatever reason, that stood out for me. So I'm wondering if you have customers that are very sensitive, palate-wise, and maybe ask you for a specific note, like lavender or something to that effect.
Absolutely. We have that quite often. You get, I would say your novice wine drinker who really isn't comfortable with their palate and is used to letting people tell them what they like. And that's a great guide to let you try new wines, or finding a wine steward or someone at a wine shop or a wine bar that will guide you and expose you to new wines. But the more astute wine consumer, I guess, they know certain flavor characteristics they like and what they're looking for in a wine, and they're able to be more specific as to describe what they're looking for in a wine. And I think where I can work with that, it makes it a lot easier for me. I take copious notes when I taste my wines here with the sales reps, and I will taste anywhere from 35 to 75 wines a week right here at the shop. And out of those 35, 75 wines, maybe 5 are worth bringing in for me, price being the first and foremost thing, and quality. And does it taste like what it says on the label? If it says it's a Cabernet, it should taste like a Cabernet. It should be varietally correct. And I think there's nothing wrong with a big red blend or a red blend and just come up with a, you know, wonderful name, a catchy name that works, but don't call it a Cabernet when it doesn't taste like a Cabernet. If you're putting other things in there, but you're so set on, you know, calling it one thing, people look for that, and it really makes it difficult to decipher those characteristics and those taste characteristics. But getting back to the person, where I struggle is when you read the back of a wine label and it says hints of Himalayan blueberries or African sage, and even with all of my wine background and wine knowledge, I feel stupid at times because I don't know what a Himalayan blueberry tastes like. So if I'm not tasting that, is there something wrong with me? And if I'm feeling that way, how does the, you know, the novice consumer feel, or someone who consumes wine on a regular basis? I think you taste what you taste and what you've been exposed to. And when someone finally points out pear, well, then you go, oh, of course it's a pear. And we were just talking about streetlights and the dimming of the starlight. And until someone shared with you the light and how it was directed, you never thought of why the stars were not as visible. And now that you know that certain shapes of streetlights make it more visible, so too when someone describes a pear in a wine, where of course you know that, but you didn't know why. I think there are certain characteristics that are in wines that we all taste. We just don't trust our senses. And when you taste wines blindfold, you find that even more apparent. We really do not trust our sense, and all of our sense, whether they're taste, sight. Your eyes will deceive you and your mouth will not. When you're blindfolded, you really don't know what to think.
Well, it was great when I, you know, learned that it was a pear, because that helped me describe when somebody asked me what type of wine you like. Now I can say, well, okay, pears are light. There's not a strong. I've tried wines with blackberry and it's too sweet. Like, okay, I don't like the sweetness in my wine. I love blackberries, but I don't like it in my wine. This is one thing that's interesting to me, are the blends, which you mentioned earlier, because there are some blends that I can't get enough of, and others just, this didn't work on any level, and you pass it around the table and everybody's making faces, but it's still out there because I guess they're hoping somebody would buy it, and it really should be at the 99-cent store.
Exactly, and you find that time and time again. Like I said, when I'm tasting those wines, very few make the cut, and a lot of that is due to that reason right there. A blend is a wonderful thing. If you think of a chef and he goes to his spice drawer to spice a certain dish, and if he's limited to one or two spices, the dish can be wonderful or it can be just awful. If he has more spices or more ingredients to add to that dish, those ingredients together just make something incredible. And the same is true with wine. When you have 3 to 5 different wines that work well together and they marry up together well, it's magic. And when you don't, you notice it right away. There's something that just doesn't work. It's awkward. It's an awkward marriage. They become divorced. And I think that's what the customer or that group of wine drinkers are tasting, that awkwardness as to a marriage that you see the people are happy and they're laughing. And that's true of a wine.
Yeah, I suspect that some of those are marriage's convenience because they want to unload.
Or so. Tradition. You know, a lot of them are based on tradition. And that's what you see in the beer industry right now, is so many people are so steeped in tradition, like the Germans. They have the wonderful history of beer making, but they're so set in their traditions that they're not looking at the bigger picture. And you see some of these young brewers here in California, East Coast and West Coast, just breaking those traditions and trying new things. And we're exposed to a whole new wonderful world of craft beer. And it's the non-traditional brewing practices. And I think the same is true for the wine, because Europe was so steeped in tradition. You go to the French, there are only certain grapes that can be grown in certain regions and only certain wines that can be made. You can't even plant another grape if it's not in that family that they've deemed this region grows this only this type of grape. And I think that's what's happening here in California. We're finally figuring out what grows well in other areas. It's taken a long time, and the Europeans have been doing it for hundreds of thousands of years. We're barely just scratching the winemaking here in California. And there are so many regions. And
different microclimates.
Exactly. And just like fruit and vegetables. You know, this fruit basket, this cornucopia of produce. And so is true with grapes, but not every grape grows well in every area. And we're figuring that out. And it's wonderful because there's so many different regions where you have the Central Coast and Santa Barbara, and then you have Monterey, which is absolutely wonderful. And then you have the North Coast. You have Amador County. It's not just Napa anymore. There are so many outlying areas that are figuring out what grows and what wines they can make that are suited to that area.
Now, you originated wine-wise in the Napa area, is that correct?
Actually started here in Winters. My first winemaking adventure, I would say, was here at Winters Winery, and that was 20 years ago. I'm coming up on my 20th anniversary of winemaking, and it's been quite a journey.
Now, how old were you?
Well, we discuss age.
I've been on the planet a while.
I was going to be 30 years old. I was coming up on my 30th.
Okay, so you weren't a little kid then.
I had other wine jobs. I was a salesman for a big distributor here, and I'm just not a corporate person. And that what it came down to, it wasn't about the wine. It was about a number. It was a commodity, and that's what it is. And it doesn't matter how much you know about wine or love wine. It's selling that flavor of the month. And I wasn't good at that. I was interested in the whole world of wine. That didn't suit that type or my type of the wine industry. But it was a great background, and it helped lead me here, and it gave me a good background for what I'm doing here and able to work with the distributors. But the winemaking was wonderful. It opened up a whole new realm that I thought was not available to me.
You probably talked to a lot of guys that have been in it for a while that share little tips and hints.
Yes, and that was the wonderful thing about the wine industry. It was such a small knit community. And so I started here in Winters and spent 3 years, almost four, and then met my wife, and we moved to Amador County and got a job at Sobon Estate Shenandoah Vineyards with Leon Sobon. And that was someone willing to share his knowledge in a practical sense, touch, taste, feel, rather than book knowledge. There's a whole world of winemaking outside of the lab and the chemistry. And it goes back to the old way of making wines that, you know, you taste the grape, you see what works, you taste it, you work with it, you touch it with your hands. And unless something goes wrong, that's when you need the chemistry. Or to make it consistent year after year, where these bigger wineries come in and they need a consistent product year after year, and that's what the chemistry is great for, but not for that individual small winery that wants to make something unique and individualistic every year. It's going to be different. And we've gotten away from that. We want a consistent product, and that's really not my vision of wine or what wine should be. The grape should do the work, and a lot of times the winemaker does the work. So,
I met this gentleman who had purchased 10 or 12 acres in Lake County. He was so interested in using the soil to possibly grow a small vineyard of his own, like a boutique size, nothing large. And researching the property, he found it actually had been a vineyard about 100 years ago. And he was so excited you could almost see his tail wagging. There was already wine history in the soil. Heard a couple more incidents of that in California, where they've learned that 100 years ago, that was once planted there, and bringing it back, like the phoenix, bringing it back to life, which is lovely to hear. So you have different stories of a glass of wine, not just the current, but all that that came before.
That's the wonderful thing, is that story that you can tell. And every story is different. They're similar, but they're different. And again, grapes were planted hundreds of years ago with European settlers bringing over what they had from their home country. And phylloxera came and wiped out a lot of vineyards, unfortunately. So what may have been a vineyard at one time went by the wayside and either was planted with a nut or a, you know, stone fruit or something else completely different. And California had a lot of history in wine, not just Napa, Sonoma. That seemed to be the rebirth of the California wine industry, but San Jose, Santa Clara, Livermore Valley, Temecula, in that area down in, you know, the arid, almost desert of Southern California. So there are so many different areas, and again, it's where the settlers were first, and they brought with them their heritage and their grapes and whatever they grew at home, and a lot of them didn't work here. It's just like the winemaking. It just, you have to go with what works, and I think we figured that out. It's a wonderful story, and everyone wants to share their story. It's fun if you stop and listen.
Say next.
Number 3, they're now serving number 16. And that seems what Napa's become. It's a commodity again. And that's where I was so, I guess, awakened to the real wine industry. When I came from Amador County down to Napa, I took a job as assistant winemaker at Carneros Creek Winery. And when I got there, it was just harvest time was beginning. And what I noticed were, instead of grape trucks with gondolas of grapes in the back, they were tanker trucks. These bright silver double tanker trucks going back and forth. And I thought about it for a minute. They're juice. They're shipping juice. So this beautiful package that Napa has. And they make some wonderful wines, and they're steeped in history. But it's business. And that's what it comes down to. And there, it hurt, actually, to see that. And to go away from that small community where we shared things with your neighbor or the person down in the valley, if you ran out of something, you could rely on your neighbor. And that's what was so wonderful. And Napa didn't have that anymore. It was big business, and it was corporations coming in, and it was about numbers again, getting back to numbers. How many gallons of wine can we make from this one vineyard? And there are still some wonderful wines that are made on that boutique basis, but the price, again, I have a hard time with prices. And my whole philosophy, as I shared with you the other night, was it doesn't have to be expensive to be good. And there are some wonderful wines out there that are not expensive, and they are wonderful.
I grew up in Sacramento, and I was really surprised as a lot of when Lodi suddenly appeared on the wine scene. Like, Lodi? Just remember, stuck in Lodi again. Now all of a sudden it's a go-to place. Like, what happened?
I think what happened was, what I was saying before, is that we figured out what works in certain areas. Tokai was known for the Royal Tokai. That was the grape of Lodi, and they have had high schools named after areas in the region named after that. And that's what grape worked back then. As people became more sophisticated, or they wanted other wines than Muscatel and Royal Tokai, it took Lodi a long time to break that image. And now they're growing some wonderful Zinfandels and Chenin Blanc, you know, in the Clarksburg area, a little bit further away from Lodi. But no one would ever have thought of Clarksburg as a wine-growing region. It was just a region you drove through on the River Road
exactly.
to get somewhere else. And now we're finding this wonderful region that grows these wonderful wines. And Lodi has the same thing. These second and third generation farmers are now, they've gone off either to Fresno State, Cal Poly, UC Davis, and studied how to grow different growing techniques, different winemaking techniques, and brought that back and kind of revitalized those areas. And Lodi is a wonderful example of that. Again, Zinfandel is a wonderful grape that comes from that area. But there's Petit Sirah, there's Viognier, there's a lot of the Rhone varietals, Mourvèdre and Syrah. And it's just nice to see that. And same with the foothills. It was always known for Zinfandel. Zinfandel, well, Amador, El Dorado County, Zinfandel. Well, we're finding that there's a lot of other grapes like Barbera, Sangiovese, Syrah, again, the Rhone varietals, and certain climates. If you look at Europe, if you drew a line, I think, almost across the parallels, you'd see certain regions of Europe would be hitting those same parallels with the Rhone region in France or the Italian area, and that's growing those Barberas and Sangioveses and Montepulciano's. And it's really nice to see that instead of just one grape, Cabernet, Chardonnay, that doesn't work everywhere. That works great in Napa. They're still the king and queen. And Cabernet is still the king of red, and Chardonnay is still the queen of white. But you're seeing other grapes slowly make their way into that kingdom. And what's nice, too, is you see the second and third generation of immigrants to the country and to the state now start drinking wine as a part of their daily lifestyle. An immigrant from Mexico, his grandfather worked the land. His father went to school and got an education, maybe worked the land, and now his son, that third generation, was bound to go to school. That was your one goal for your parents, to put you through school. And now they've come back. They're running the winery. They're owning wineries. They're making wonderful wines. And I really think that's going to be the big growth sector for the wine industry. And you'll see larger production wines being made a lot better and a lot less expensive because people want to drink wine every day as part of their daily life and their meal. And that's what we do here. We really, it's not about drinking. It's about enjoying the product, including it as part of your meal. It's a healthy part of the lifestyle. And as long as everything in balance, you know, everything in moderation, a glass or two of wine a day is a good, healthy part of that. But seeing that sector grow like it will is really, it makes me happy because it's not just these little boutique wines that are making good wines. You're seeing better and better large production facilities making better and better wines because the market will demand it. You're going to find a great bottle of wine for $10 to $14 again. So that's exciting. But it's from regions we're not used to hearing. You know, the Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley, the Imperial Valley,
Now, you've done some traveling. Mm-hmm. What other countries have you visited where you had the opportunity to firsthand taste the different grapes or visit vineyards?
Argentina being the most recent, impacted. In Mendoza. We flew into Mendoza, and immediately I felt at home. There were grapes. Unlike California, where you have the valley, then you have the foothills, and then the Sierras. In Mendoza, you have the valley and then the Andes. There was no foothills. And to see that enormity and that the immense size of the Andes is breathtaking. And then to taste the grapes that are grown there is wonderful. And the amount of wine that's consumed in Argentina, we have no idea of. And the little amount that they export is, I think it's 10%, I'm not sure numbers, but very small compared to what they consume there in that country. And it's about the lifestyle. It's about social interaction. And that's what I really liked, is that it was part of your meal. It was part of your evening stroll when you were out and you were sitting in a piazza on the street, having a bite with friends and of all ages and generations getting together. And the wines were incredible. And they were just good, solid, everyday wines. It wasn't about fancy $100 bottles. It was about a $3 bottle or even, I think, a 5-liter jug that you brought to the winery, or the winery filled for you. And it was a plastic 5-liter jug with two handles on either side of it, like a net. And that's how you carried it home. And you drank because it was part of your meal. You didn't see people getting drunk and sloppy out on the streets. It was just a wonderful social activity. I hope that's what we get to hear. And I think we will at some point, but Argentina was spectacular. And the people were wonderful. We were in Italy for a time, in the central part of Italy. We were in Tuscany. And the same thing there. You really saw a connection with the land. And what they grew was part of their meal. They had peppers and several other items growing, but then they had grapes. Almost everyone makes their own wine in Italy. Some of the best wines were the table wines. It wasn't about money. It wasn't about this expensive bottle being the best. It was about table wine being the best wine. And again, for everybody. And wine should be for everybody. Again, we have a very elitist idea of wine here, I think. People can make you feel very small, very quickly, here, with wine, whether you pronounce something correctly or you don't know something. I think that's going away, too. I think that's why people are so apprehensive to ask questions about wine, or even here at the wine bar. They're not used to letting someone tell them what they like. They're used to people telling them what they should like. And to me, that's just wrong. And it goes back to tasting the pear. I don't taste the pear. Is there something wrong with me? No, but if you taste a pear, that's what you taste. And other places are not like that. You should taste the pear. What's wrong with you? And this is a 98-point wine. Why don't you like it? What's wrong with you? You can't pronounce that name. What's wrong with you?
The bounty of nature. It's pretty basic. We're just raising the bar. And if you focus too much on it like that, then there's other issues in your life.
Right.
My perspective.
I mean,
think
we're here to share.
That important, then you have to put somebody down to make yourself feel higher, then there's a problem there. Those cases aside, it's a great unifier. Because most people enjoy a nice glass of wine, whether it's red or white, because there are definitely stands on one side or the other. Mm-hmm. Wine and beer, at least in California, as I say, is a great unifier.
Right. And again, that's what we see here. People will talk to complete strangers, and it's wonderful to see that. And it's the glass of wine, and I think the atmosphere we have here is comfortable, casual, and that's what we wanted. When someone's explaining to me what they like, and they say they don't like sweet wines, and I said, okay, we'll try this. And I think I shared a white wine with you the other night, and it was from Italy. It was an Arnais, and it had fruit sweetness, but it wasn't sugary, syrupy sweet. When you describe your blackberries, and you love blackberries, but you don't like that jammy, and it's sweetness again. It comes back to that sappy, syrupy sweet. Some of those first wines we had, maybe that were white Zinfandels or Boone's Farm, they were sweet.
Boone's Farm, oh my God.
They were sweet wines, and
there's
that's
a flashback.
Most of us are introduced to sweet wines because
Strawberry Hill, remember?
Exactly, it's a step. Or wine coolers.
Yes.
California Cooler and Bartles and James. And it was a step, it was an introduction into the wine, and then our palates change and we try new things. Again, another fun thing for me here is when people say they don't like sweet wines, it's pouring something for them without letting them see the name or the type of wine. And it's not to be tricky, and it's not to tease them or judge them in any way. It's to allow them to taste the wine on their own without letting their eyes deceive them in a way, or have preconceived notions, because so many of us have had a bad experience with a certain wine and we're reluctant to try that wine again. And again, with the Arnais the other night, it's so much fun because I think you wanted a dry wine, a dry white. And this had some sweetness and it had some effervescence, but it wasn't sweet. It had fruit.
It wasn't heavy. It was perfect.
Yeah.
It was delicious.
And seeing that wine on the shelf, the chances of a person picking that up are slim to none, unless they know that. And again, that's the wonderful thing that we do here, is being able to share that and open those eyes and seeing that light bulb go on and just that smile on their face and to know that they weren't being tricked.
And I'm not a wine groupie, which is why I would... There are, of course, certain types that I do prefer over others if I'm given a limited choice. Mm-hmm. But I always like to try new ones every time I go out. You also presented me some delicious locally made crackers and some pepper jelly or cheese, and it was just perfection.
It goes back to wine and cheese. Keep it simple.
But I think the locally made crackers, I think, really brought the bar up. You know, it wasn't, even that wasn't mass produced. That wasn't a large chain either.
Right.
So I think that all of that together, all the pieces, made it into a perfect whole.
I agree. And I think that locally, again, local's better. Fresh is better. It goes back to the thing of shipping. You know, how far things shipped. And when you really learn how far your tomato came from, or your basket of strawberries, or your loaf of bread, you're amazed and your eyes are opened. The more things we can get locally, fresh products like the crackers or the cheeses or toppings that we're now using, it's only going to get better and better. But I think when you're in Europe, you eat when in Rome. And I think we need to get back to that, you know, and try to get things as close to the area that we can, that are grown there.
Well, speaking of local, how about some of the local wineries that maybe my listeners aren't aware of?
I think that we are, in this area in particular, I think we're figuring out what works here. I think a lot of the winemakers here struggled for a long time trying to grow certain grapes and trying to fit a round peg into a square hole, and it just doesn't work. You know, the Tempranillo grape is a perfect example. It's a great grape for this region, and I think some of the local winemakers are making good Tempranillos, and they're figuring out what wines work. I know there's some Rhones that Turkovich is making. He's making a GSM, which is a Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, which are three Rhone varietals. And again, go back to our blend. Those three on their own might make a mediocre wine, but together they're magic. And then the Syrah Viognier, I believe he makes. Very nice. And again, those Rhone region wines, grapes, that work here too. And I think what's not working is we have mindsets as to what they want to grow. People have certain heritages and they're just going to grow those types of grapes. And a lot of times they don't work. And, you know, hopefully we get to that point where we're just going to grow the grapes, let the grape do the work again, find out what works. And Wooden Valley, for example, a little bit further south of here, west of here, I guess, Wooden Valley and Sassoon Valley, they're making some wonderful wines. And if you throw a rock, you could hit Napa. You know, it's just up and over the hill from Napa. But because it doesn't have that name recognition and that. You looked at a map and you saw where Sassoon is. It's just, again, 20 miles, not even 20 miles.
It's the poor sister, huh?
Yeah, exactly. It's the redheaded stepchild. And then they're figuring out what works there. And there's some wonderful wines coming out of that region. Clarksburg, still Yellow County, wonderful wines. I know there's some great wines coming just north of here. Matchbook is making some wonderful wines. And there's some nice organic wines being made. But the region's figuring out what works. And that's a wonderful thing. I know they're promoting it, and a lot more people are coming and realizing that, you know, we're the gateway to the eastern gateway to Napa. And it's wonderful when people stop here and they realize what we have here instead of just going straight through to get to Napa. And their eyes are open, and even here at the shop, they walk in and say, "Wow, you have this wine?" I said, "Yes, I do. Welcome to Winners." They're amazed. And then when they sit down and they taste the wide variety of wines we have, there's a lot of things people weren't aware of 5 years ago. And they are now here in Winners. And I think that's the change that this area is making, both in the grape and the winemaking and just the area in general, as to food. You know, there's tapas restaurants here now and other locally, you know, sourced, what is it, fork to table? That's the new buzzword. And it's wonderful. And it's not just the big food meccas anymore. You know, Sacramento has some wonderful restaurants, and you would not have thought of that 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, thinking Sacramento is a food, you know, an epicurean center. It was always San Francisco.
The health food movement has really made a difference for Sacramento.
Absolutely, and you look at where we are. We're in the middle of the fruit basket again. Your stuff can come from right over the river, right across the 5 miles to 10 miles, and you can get almost everything you need. And again, fresher is better. It just goes back to that.
Now, if the average person, if their only choice is to walk into their local chain supermarket, Trader Joe's has wines from different countries, like Chile and Australia. But if someone was going to a chain supermarket, they were feeling overwhelmed, they want to try something different, or maybe they're going to a dinner party and they want to bring, of course, a bottle for the host or hostess. Sometimes the people that work in the wine department are knowledgeable and sometimes they are not. Besides asking the assistant there, the clerk, what types of wines there are for their taste bud, are there certain ways, certain questions you can ask where you can tell whether that person is knowledgeable or not, or if that's just their day job?
I worked at Nugget Markets right before opening up Main Street Cellars and had wonderful relationships with a lot of our guests. And what I told them is, where you live, you find a wine shop, a supermarket, a Trader Joe's, a BevMo, you find someone that you're comfortable working with that's not the pimple-faced kid, you know, stocking the shelves, and you just find someone you're comfortable with. And it might be any number of grocery stores or chain stores, but I think there are enough in the area that you could find someone that you're comfortable with. And once you build that relationship, they kind of know what you want. And I think there are enough people out there that are knowledgeable. I think we just have to seek them out and not just go to one shop. If you've had a bad experience, go to the shop across town. You know, a lot of times we don't have that ability, but I think if you don't have that, I think you do a little reading, you do a little research, and you find a publication that you're comfortable with. There's so many wine blogs out there now, and writers and magazines, and I think you find a wine publication that you're comfortable with, or an online blog, wine column, something.
It's not too arrogant.
Right, and that jives with your tastes, and you try a couple of their recommendations, you like them, and again, you build that relationship over online. And you have a guide. So I think there's enough sources out there now that you're not just stuck into one choice. That's what I did at first. It was Dan Berger, actually, in the, I think the Santa Rosa Democrat. I can't remember what the name of the paper was. But his tastes were, you know, a lot of the wine recommendations he had were different. And there were wines I hadn't heard of. But they were available and accessible. And that's the one thing I find a drawback to some of the bigger named wine magazines. They rate these wines or review them. And all of a sudden you go out and you can't find them. So I think finding something that's available, a wine tasting group, starting a tasting group with your friends, and everybody brings one bottle of the same varietal and you put it into a bag. But everyone went out and bought that wine that day, so there are wines that are available, currently available, and then you taste them and come up with what you like. Again, it's a way to taste in a group forum that is just social and fun. It's a good way to get a good cross-section of wines, and maybe they found something that you couldn't, and vice versa. But that wine you can go out and buy tomorrow, and that's the wonderful thing about it.
We were talking earlier about some wines, vineyards have stories. Do you have any fun stories that you can share?
The fun one would be making wine with my son. After leaving Napa and coming to Nugget Markets, I started making wine with home winemakers. And I think sharing what you know with people that you take for granted, the things we've learned. And instead of asking, don't you know, don't you know, don't you know, and I stopped because they don't know. And seeing the light bulb again go on and smiles go across their face. Because you work hard when you make wine, and a lot of these people grow their own grapes, and you work hard all year to make this product, and a lot of times it's not drinkable because they don't have the knowledge. And sharing that was absolutely wonderful, and helping so many people make better wines and be proud of their achievement. And one experience I had, my son was 8 years old, and what was fun making wine with this one group of all home winemakers, it was communal again. It got back to how they used to make wine. It was a party, it was a celebration, and everyone would show up at 6 or 7 in the morning and pick the grapes. And there would be a feast, wonderful lunch, and just wonderful communion with people. And then the bottling, and it was a whole nother party and a celebration, and that was the end. So you were putting into bottle all of your hard work, and then to taste that, and the reward at the end of great wine was a drinkable wine, great wine. It's all subjective. This one particular wine that we were making with my son, again, reinvigorated my belief in the wine industry after leaving Napa and being disillusioned. The grapes we bought were Petit Sirah, and they were from Wooden Valley. And I had established a relationship with Ron Lanza, who was making wine. He was one of the Lanzas from Wooden Valley Winery. And my father, in the 60s, used to stop on his way home from Sacramento at Wooden Valley Winery and buy, you know, the red wine from Wooden Valley. And I still can see that label to this day on certain bottles that he used for other things in the garage, or the boxes that he put slides in later. And they had the Wooden Valley logo on them. And meeting Ron Lanza when I was at Nugget, it was wonderful. He is a wonderful, wonderful person. And the family is what winemaking was about. It made me want to make wine again. And it was handshake deals. There was, you know, it wasn't about money. It wasn't about contracts. It was about, you want to make wine, here are the grapes. So we made this Petit Sirah, and my son was there from the minute the grapes came in to when we bottled it. And again, it was a little bit of everybody. It was It was the group that we were making it with. They were there. It wasn't anything fancy. It was made in a garage in a driveway. And we took pictures the whole way through to have that chronology of a photo chronology, I guess, or photo history of my son making grapes was just so rewarding. And then, unbeknownst to me, they turned the wines into the state fair. A while later, people in town here started saying, congratulations on that. And I said, on what? And they said, oh, you won the double gold medal. I said, no, you got the wrong guy. Oh, congratulations, you've won this. I'm like, oh, God. And the home winemakers, I think you've got the wrong one. Well, then we got a notice in the mail saying we'd won a double gold medal.
And double gold?
Double gold, 99 points, best Petit Sirah in California. And I found out later that that group had turned in all their wines to the state home winemakers competition. And the funny thing was we had had two wines to choose from. We had two blends that we were working with. I chose one and my son chose one. And the one he chose is the one that we ended up bottling and that won the double gold medal.
Nice.
And it goes back to his palate doesn't have a lot of, it's not been exposed to a lot of garbage. It's a pure palate. Again, it's about family. We went to the award ceremony and he was upset because he couldn't get in because it was 21 and over. And I had my father there. He's the one that really shared a lot of that with me and I was lucky enough to have that. And we didn't tell him what we were going there for. And when he saw that my name was called up for that, it was pretty cool. And then we took pictures. Deborah D'Angelo did a wonderful article here.
So your son wasn't there, but your father's son was there.
Yep.
Here's your wine-related quote for the day from comedian Stephen Wright. I made wine out of raisins so I wouldn't have to wait for it to age. Do something different. Visit a museum in your hometown.